So, did Roberts assign you this problem?
I think it was more or less an assignment. He talked to me in terms of, boy, here's something exciting for us to look at. And of course, if he said it was exciting to look at, I thought it was exciting to look at too. So I don't think he said, this is what you're going to do. But yeah, it was certainly his problem. It had bothered him. He was familiar with this very old Demyanov work and the rearrangement of cyclobutanols, and he wanted to learn more about that. And this silver reaction without solvent was sort of bizarre, because you've got more or less a non-classical carbonium ion distribution, but with no solvent present. So. It's one of the stranger reactions I've ever performed, because you grind these things together gently and mix them and put them in a vial and heat them up. There's a big burst of purple light, and it's all over in a flash, and here are all of these three interconversion products of cyclobutyl carbonium ion as esters in there.
Did this give you a chance to interact with Robert's group as a whole, graduate students?
Yeah. What he did was he assigned a half or a third or part of a lab bench of a graduate student to a undergraduate. And as a matter of fact, the guy whose bench I worked at was Rudy Carboni, who also came to Central Research here in DuPont. And he and his family were subsequently great friends of ours. He was just starting in grad school. He had spent some years in the service and was quite a bit, 6 or 7 years older than I was. But we became close friends and through that beginning. So that was great, because you had some older graduate students to look to for help in the courses.
When you entered MIT in 47, had you already planned going on through the PhD? Was that?
I think so.
Have you given any thought beyond that point?
No. I don't know. I never had a clear thought that I was going to teach, because I really didn't know that much about it until I got into graduate school and saw what life was really like and knew more about it. I think when I was working with Jack, I came more and more to that thought. And actually, after 2 years in grad school, Jack left and moved to Caltech. And jumping ahead a bit, the thesis that I'd done for him, he said I was finished. And in essence, Cope said, "No, you're not." And so I stayed and worked for Cope for a year. Jack had arranged a postdoc for me with Pauling. And at Caltech, and my wife and I were thinking about doing this, but I was in the Army Reserve and was under active duty orders to appear at Fort McClellan, Alabama, and to be frank with you, that certainly colored my view of this. In the meantime, as a graduate student, Ted Cairns, who was at that time was a science director here, had met me when he was poking around up there at MIT, and he had invited me down here on a visit, not a formal interview, but an earlier one, a year early, And so he really knew how to recruit people. And he made it very clear to me that there was a job here, and I was terribly impressed when I saw the experimental station and found out people were doing, in industry, doing honest-to-goodness chemistry here. So having that option available and having a lot of flack from the Army, I told Jack that I was going to put that aside, and for a while maybe I'd think about it, but I was going to, in those days we talked crazy things like, well, we'd go to work for a couple of years and maybe go back or something. So at any rate, I ended up coming to industry. But the thing that moved me here was Ted Cairns, I think, more than anything else. There have been a lot of internally important chemists, some with external importance too, in the old chemical department at DuPont. But Ted Cairns was the guy who made this into a modern chemistry laboratory. He brought in fields that were traditionally not here, like physical organic chemistry. This place was entirely synthetic and dominated by Illinois people, and as Ted was himself. But he recognized the value of bringing in some MIT physical organic chemist and things like this. So he did a great deal in terms of bringing in very qualified people and making sure they got promoted. There was a time here when the science directors were Bill Phillips, Earl Mutertes, me, and Ralph Hardy, and three of us were Academy members before we finished. So. And these were all handpicked people by Ted. So I mean, Ted's influence here was really incredible when you compare this with the old days. It's not that what was going on before was bad. It was just Ted trying to move us into the 20th century a little faster. So he's the reason I came, as I say, came here. And,
let me go back to some MIT questions. You had indicated that Coe's policy was not to let people go on, and he made an exception. Did that take much persuasion on your part or Robert's part?
I think Jack must have been the one who talked him into this. Ken Koppel worked for Sheehan, and Sheehan got Koppel to stay on, and there was, I believe there was a third person that year. Can't remember. But in general, the average year was zero. There were very few people that that stayed on. And I think Art recognized that his principle was a good one, but that if there were promising students that really wanted to stay, it was sort of dumb maybe not to keep them in. So,
how would you describe Cope as your interactions with him?
Well, I knew Art as a student and as a young scientist here. Then as a supervisor, it took me several years to get around to calling him Art. He was not the kind of guy that you call Art very fast. I always liked him. He presented to me always a very rational, gentle face. I always had the impression that he genuinely liked me and confided and talked to me frankly about things here or elsewhere. So I had only a very good experience with him, and I think most of the students that worked for him that were tolerably good students had the same view. He was not a hard taskmaster, although he was demanding. He was he expected a fair amount out of his students. So at any rate, when I stayed on for my third year, I worked on the rearrangements of trans cyclooctane oxide and the transannular hydride shifts that occur with that. So I really enjoyed that, and after a year he let me go. But you know, he was a good friend of Ted Cairns, and Ted Cairns actually came to my PhD orals.
Okay.
I don't think Dr. Koch probably should have let people in like this. But he was a good friend of Cairns's, and Cairns actually came to my orals and listened to them.
So your thesis work is considered more the work with Koch than...
No, the thesis with Roberts was very intense. I started the benzyne problem for Jack. Actually, after several months, Jack went to Europe for almost a year, for several months. So we were not together a lot of this time. Except I wrote to him every couple of weeks and told him to send him reports, lab reports. And while he was gone, I made the first C14 labeled chlorobenzene, made benzyne from it, ran through the sequence and demonstrated the equivalency of the orthocarbons. Also made the deuterohalobenzenes, chloro and fluoro and bromobenzenes, ortho and para, and looked at the hydride exchanges under the reaction conditions and others. And he told me maybe a year or so ago, he said, I look back in those notebooks and he said, that was all really great stuff. He said, it was all right. And so I had a really great start in being allowed to do it on your own. And so he considered what I had done enough in terms of original work and new techniques and that sort of thing to be done in 2 years, and that was not totally unheard of in those mm-hmm. days. There were a lot of good people that might have gotten out in that two or 2.5 years. He wanted me to come with him, and I wasn't going to come with him because of the army problems. And so I said, you don't want to get into us, but everything was quiet with the military dealing, and with MIT dealing, I didn't want to start all this stuff again by trying to move schools in the course of this, when we just finished telling them that it was necessary that I be there. So at any rate, I did, actually, during my, in the first part of my thesis, I worked on some small ring chemistry for Jack, too, besides the benzyne work. Benzyne was the major part of my thesis. The secondary part of it was the trans-cyclooctane oxide, and the third part of it was some...
there was a paper with phenylacetylene and...
Right.
Is that the one?
That's right.
Okay. I wanted to ask you... I'll tell you first, then I'll ask my question. But your benzyne paper was the very first paper I gave as a seminar when I was a graduate student in 1957. And I had two questions relating to that. One, how did you get into this concept in the first place?
This had been bothering Jack for a long time in reading the old literature. I can't remember the references now, but he had been unable to rationalize in his mind or on paper mechanistically how some of these very strange rearrangements occurred under very mild conditions. And they were unprecedented electronically, unless you did something as crazy as to say, well, a simple elimination reaction occurs, and then addition occurs back to this very short-lived, highly energetic intermediate. So he had speculated that this would be that this might be an intermediate, and told me about it and asked if I wanted to work on it, seeing if I could demonstrate it.
The other part of my question relates to my experience in giving that first seminar, and I was first year as a graduate student, because I remember the reaction afterwards is that a number of people there didn't believe it.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what your experience was in that.
Well, the problems, the answer to that question is, well, then explain the equivalency of the position holding the halogen and the ortho positions.
Did you get much skepticism from that paper?
Get much what?
Skepticism from
that paper. Oh, yeah. There are others who believed it from the beginning, like George Wittig. And Wittig, of course, did his own work on this. I think that had a lot. And the Germans quite accepted this, and there were some pretty good people in Germany in that period. But in particular, I think Wittig was a believer. Saul Lindstein, I think, was a believer.
Okay.
That's what it really took, is a few folks like that.
What was it like in let's say those last few years at MIT? What was it like working in the laboratory? What other people that were with you? And
yeah, it was great. For 1 year, Andy Streitwiser and I were lab mates. We had some large labs where maybe five graduate students or six would have half of a big bench. We also had some very small labs that were just two-man labs, and I was lucky enough to be in one of those and with Andy. And in those days, Andy and I were at each other's throats more than anything else. He was an obnoxious young bastard, I thought, and but very bright. And we didn't get along too well, actually, until I was out of school and here, and Andy and I started seeing each other professionally for one thing or the other, and I got him here consulting, and we ultimately became good friends over virtually all of our career, but it started out with a lot of antagonism. Now, I was a graduate student and he was a postdoc, and he didn't have much faith in anyone who didn't think pretty much like Andy did in those days, but he mellowed a great deal over a period of time, and I came to greatly admire him. We were good friends over virtually all of our career, but didn't start that way. But it was good because he was very bright, and it was nice sharing a lab with people like that.
Anyone else?
Yeah, there were some pretty potent folks around at that time as students. There was a man, Bob Mazur, who went off to the drug industry. He was probably the most brilliant student Roberts ever had, and I think Jack would still claim that might be true. It was one of this fellow Mazur he had at the very early part of his career. And I can't remember which drug. He was a physical organic guy, and it was very strange for him to go to a drug house, but he did and adapted to that and did some a lot of very important things later on. I can't recall what they were now, but did very, very well with a professional career in the pharmaceutical industry. Everyone that knew Mazur thought that he was truly exceptional. He's the sort of person who would go to the cyclotron and get some hot chlorine that was made that afternoon, and rush back, make hydrochloric acid, make Lucas reagent, make a halide and solvolyze it, and measure the rates of a radioactive isotope that only had a few hours half-life. This was the sort of, and he did those things and did them beautifully. He had a very was a deep thinker and a powerful thinker. And so I think Bob Mazur was a guy that really influenced me a good deal. As I said, Rudy Carbone, who was a very good organic chemist himself, became a personal friend and also came down here to DuPont. E.J. Corey was just getting out of there when I was starting. We overlapped very briefly, but I was starting grad school when E.J. was finishing. I think we overlapped a year. I was a first-year student when he was a last-year student. And I knew him, but that's about all I could say. Not, I really didn't get to know him until later years.
Well, as we said earlier, that must have been a very exciting time with the group you were in and the events that were happening in chemistry.
Well, it was the events of chemistry. As I say, almost every named reaction or known reaction was up for grabs in terms of speculating or working on it mechanistically. And it didn't have to be done with the depth of a Jerry Burson, with all the infinite nitpicking details. It could be done in the way of a Hines, and who, I guess my interest was somewhere sort of in between those two. Jack's sort of approach to it, I liked. Yeah.
Did you meet Hammett at all during that?
No, never met. Heard him, but never met him. Still on this, now, if you look back at that period and look at his book, he laid out enough information. There's enough information there that any industry in the United States could begin to look at processes that they were running and probably save themselves millions of dollars by understanding a little better about the mechanisms of what they were doing. And but he was an honest-to-God father in this, in physical organic, although he was a physical chemist, but he was nevertheless the real father of physical organic chemistry as far as I was concerned, because he and Paul Bartlett, maybe.
Did you do much, I mean, as a graduate student, certainly you were reading the current literature. Did you read any of the older literature at the time?
Not so
Roberts
much.
Was doing.
Yeah, not so much as a grad student, but when I came to DuPont, this became a real hobby, and I really pored over the old stuff because I found that there was just a gold mine of things that. That might be speculate, you know, you could speculate on, and that might have a modern interpretation that would make them very exciting. As later on, the cyclopropanation reaction that I worked on was exactly that way of looking. I came across these old references of Emschwiller and reading about his getting ethylene out of very mild conditions of methylene iodide and this bizarre zinc copper couple. There were ways of interpreting that as either a low energy methylene or a carbenoid, which were unknown. As a matter of fact, that turned out to be the first carbenoid. And I spent a lot of time at nights. So there were two or three of us that were interested, friends here that I was. We'd come over and pore over the old barricades and that sort of thing at night.
Did MIT as an undergraduate have any course in chemical literature or history of chemistry? They were somewhat common in those days.
If it did, I don't have any recollection of it at all. No, I didn't take it, but I don't.
Okay, I just wondered about that.
Those were great undergraduate days. I had economics with Paul Samuelson, and Paul and I are both on the finance committee of the academy now, and it's incredible that that would be so. DeSantiana and philosophy isn't. I mean, the Institute was a grand place after the war because of the, you know, you never thought very much of it as a school for the humanities, but they were making a real effort to have quality education in the humanities there. So I never thought that we were short-shifted. But,
how much humanities did you take?
Only what was necessary. Yeah, I'm afraid most of what I've done in the way of fine literature and that sort of thing, which is appreciable since I've been a voracious reader, has been afterwards. And but in terms of formal education along those lines, not a whole lot.